Enter, if you dare.
Once again to Dark Discussions, your place for discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I am one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the U.S. of A., and with me in the state of New York.
Hi, this is Mike.
Mike, how's it going?
I'm fine, Phil. How are you?
Doing all right. And in the state of Massachusetts?
Hey, everyone, this is Abe.
Abe, how's it going, my friend?
I'm doing good.
Excellent. There's two other co-hosts, but unfortunately, neither of them could make it tonight due to, one's, traveling and one, is at a work event. For folks who are curious, it's, Mike's wife, Pam, usually wants to know, we are recording this on October 10th, 2019. So this is a Thursday night, 7:30 Eastern Standard Time. For folks who don't know who we are Dark Discussions Podcast. Basically, we review and critique a genre film weekly. So horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno-thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, cult, drive-in, and whatnot. We come out weekly. We have a Facebook group called Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group where there's a lot of discussion going on. So search for that, and we will add you to that group. Right now, The Joker is being discussed a whole lot. I saw some stuff about Chucky because that just came out on VOD. A couple other things of note there as well. So it's a pretty good conversation where you can join other listeners of Dark Discussions Podcast. Also, we have an email, darkdiscussions@aol.com, which you can email us your feedback, your critiques, your own personal reviews, your opinions, your suggestions, and whatnot, and we will read your email on the podcast. Also, we have a Patreon. What is that? Patreon is a place where you can donate to the podcast. For every $5 that you donate to the podcast, you can give us a name of a film that you want us to review. So basically what happens is you can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions. There's a button directly on darkdiscussions.com that will bring you to that. And for example, if you donate $15 per month, you would be able to choose three films each month for us to possibly do. So for example, $15, the end of October, you would get to choose three films. So you could choose Friday the 13th, the remake, Friday the 13th, the original, or Savage Streets, or you could do Savage Streets three times. So any combination of movies that are genre related. And what happens is at the end of the quarter, we pick out of a electronic hat one of the Patreon picks. So just last week, we picked a film called Caliber, a Scottish film. Looks like a crime thriller type film, and that is coming up as an episode. So get your Patreon picks in, just donate to the podcast. And we'd like to thank Chris Genro, who just joined up as a Patreon subscriber. We appreciate Chris. He hasn't posted some of his cool memes as much as he used to on our Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group, but he's always there. And a great contributor to the Facebook group. Now, Abe, what else can people find on darkdiscussions.com?
If you go to darkdiscussions.com, you can not only find the episodes we have uploaded thus far, all this available to listen to for free, but if you look on your right-hand side, you'll find links to blogs and other podcasts, such as certain series that Phil, Eric, and Mike cover. Some returning, some have already been concluded, such as the Game of Thrones one, You Know Nothing, Jon Snow, and some other things from some of our friends as well. So if you want to take a look at those along with our episodes, please do.
Yep, absolutely. Some of our spinoff podcasts, a brand new one that is coming out sometime in October, because we're recording episode two later this month, Cinema a la Carte, which is a podcast that talks about films that wouldn't necessarily fit. They could, but not necessarily fit as an episode of Dark Discussions podcasts. So, for example, the Western film Hostiles is our first episode, and that is coming out shortly. It may actually even be out by the time you hear this episode. And also, hey, me and you, along with two of our listeners, Barrett and Kevin, are doing a new, what are we doing? A new what? That's for December.
Previously, we have covered two novels by Stephen King. This time, however, we're switching authors to look at some of the works by H.P. Lovecraft. So stay tuned for when that episode is not only recorded, but released.
Yep, absolutely. So look out for that episode probably late December or early January, because since it's reading, we're giving ourselves 3 months to get done with the book versus, say, a movie where you can just watch it 2 hours, you're done, and we can record. Let's see. Mike, what else is going on? Any news or updates that you wanted to bring up? We did have the passing of Sid Haig, which you gave a nice memorable saying of, you know, his history with the conventions and stuff just recently. Any other news or anything? Hopefully there hasn't been any other passings. Anything you know of?
Nothing that I'm aware of off the top of my head. That's come out that's particularly newsworthy. I mean, right now, most of the movie oxygen is being sucked up by Joker, which, you know, has turned into a huge success. And, you know, it's not horror, but it is definitely dark. On the other hand, you have, I guess, I can never remember his name, the Korean director.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Parasite, the film that's Parasite.
Right. Yeah, his name is Parasite.
It's Boone or Bong. Bong, isn't it?
Bong. Yeah.
The director of The Host.
Right. The director of The Host, and was it The Wailing?
Yes.
Did he do The Wailing too? Oh, okay.
I know it's another film that we covered. I just can't remember which one it was.
Yeah, yeah. Junho Bong is the guy, and his new film Parasite is out, and he did Snowpiercer, and he did
Snowpiercer. Thank you. Yeah, that was it.
I don't think he did The Wailing, Abe.
No. I knew it was another big film. This is supposed to be a phenomenal film. It's been talked about for a while. I think it got released in 2018 overseas.
Yeah,
is getting released in the U.S. On streaming. If it's not out right now, it's, I think, within the next week. I would not be shocked to see us cover that, or, you know, being a podcast, hear us cover that within the next 2 weeks or so.
I think it actually won the best award at Cannes, right? And the Joker won the best award at Venice.
Right.
So they both came out pretty much at the same time for everybody. And continue, Mike. I'm sorry. I just wanted to.
No, that's fine. So I think that's the undercurrent of the next big thing. Horror people, we see a lot of, and, you know, being in October, we're getting a lot of people posting their daily lists. They're trying to do the 31 movies in 31 days, which does not leave a lot of people time to have a lot of conversation. I myself have not. I just am too busy during the month to be able to hit 31 films, so I'm just took it on myself to try doing 31 recommendations for people that are looking for movies to watch, movies that they're less likely to have seen, or more importantly, movies they probably even have not even heard of. So I would not recommend. So obviously, a movie that hits, like, I'm not going to recommend It, because everyone in the world that is interested in that has probably seen it. And I'm also not going to recommend something like The Void, because if you're a horror fan, you've almost certainly seen that one and heard of that one. I'm mostly picking stuff that a little bit more obscure, not completely off the charts, because I don't want something people can actually have a chance to catch. And I don't remember what did I post today?
The Golem, wasn't it? Or was that yesterday?
The Golem was yesterday because it was Yom Kippur, so I did the Golem. I thought, you know, that would be appropriate. And today, I know tomorrow is going to be Exists as a found footage film. I'm doing found footage Fridays. I don't remember what I put. That's so sad. I don't remember what my day 10 was.
Yeah, I didn't notice your post today, as a matter of fact.
I actually posted like right after midnight last night. I'm trying to get ahead of it because I'm going to have trouble doing it on Saturday.
Gotcha.
This is riveting audio. Oh, One of the Dead. I did One of the Dead as a zombie film.
Gotcha.
But anyway, so and I know you're doing the 31 films.
Yeah, I'm doing the 31 films, but I'm not really. I've only done 6 so far, and I probably won't get to 31 because not every night I'm available to watch films. But yeah, I've decided to do something completely different, where I am doing DVDs or Blu-rays that I own that I've never watched.
Okay, I see what my mistake was. The director for The Wailing was Na Hong Jin, who also did The Chaser.
Thank you for that update. So no hate mail. We corrected that. And Chaser was a damn good film too. What I'm doing is films that I have never seen before as well. And I'm also doing films that are obscure or not, you know, the typical horror films. So even though I haven't seen like a lot of the Halloweens or Friday the 13th or whatnot, I'm not doing any of those films. So I'm doing all like obscure or older films. And so far I've done 6. So I did the sci-fi horror film from the 60s called Green Slime, which I know you've seen as a child, Mike, as well as I think you recently watched it like a year or two ago as well.
Yeah, I got the Blu-ray, and it was a movie because I'd never finished it. And it was one of those things I always wanted to watch the end of it. And see, because I don't know why I found it creeped me out when I was whatever, 6 or 7, and I saw it. But I always wanted to know how it ended. Well, now I know how it ended, and it didn't end terribly well because it's not a great film. It's a cheesy Japanese monster film that does not involve kaiju, but it's a Japanese sci-fi.
And it doesn't involve Japanese people either, except for behind
the
camera.
No, it has some really bad American actors.
Yep. One of the leads is people will definitely know him from many films, Richard Jackal. The plot is actually pretty solid if you know, done in the quote unquote 60s cheesy way. You know, special effects and all that, what are you going to do? So I saw that. The Maze I saw, which is a 1953 horror film. And that was a film that was originally in 3D, but I obviously watched it in regular 2D. And that was pretty good haunted house film, very atmospheric. Then I saw the Hammer film, The Man Who Could Cheat Death, which was pretty damn good. And that one was from 1959. The Green Slime was, I think, 67 or something. And then I saw Cat People, the original film from 1942, the Val Luden film. And then I saw the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, The Next Generation, which starred Renee Zellweger and Matthew McConaughey. That was a Scream Factory disc. And then I saw Repulsion by Roman Polanski. And that's a 1965 film starring the great Catherine Deneuve, or Deneuve. It's a French name. I always screw up French names, even though I'm French. Those are the 6 I've seen so far, and I'll pick another one off the pile again, another older film. So far, I've decided to go with mostly 50s and 60s, with the exception for the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Next Generation. But maybe I'll throw in a couple of obscure 70s and 80s films too, but I'm not sure yet. What about yourself, Abe? You doing anything for Halloween, October, watching horror films or video games or anything?
Probably a little bit of both, depending on what day is that falling on this time?
Halloween, I think, is a Thursday.
Thursday, so that could be anything. Depending.
No, it is. Yeah, it definitely is a Thursday. Yeah.
Oh, it is. Yeah. It's going to really depend on my work schedule.
Right. Very well. Very well. All right. So, anything else anybody wanted to bring up, or we good until after the episode? Anyone? All right, I think we're good. So with all that stated, I guess we can get into our topic tonight. So, Mike, why don't you let everybody know what we're going to discuss tonight?
Tonight we're going to be watching the, is it 2019?
It's 2017.
Mexican, 2017 Mexican film, Tigers Are Not Afraid.
Había una vez un príncipe que quería ser tigre. Los tigres no tienen miedo.
Con el diablo.
Vienen por ti.
Los huascas saben en dónde estamos.
Se nos olvida quiénes somos. Cuando las cosas de afuera vienen por nosotros. Somos príncipes, somos guerreros y tigres. Los tigres nunca olvidan.
Si no lo matas, nos van a matar a todos.
Los tigres no tienen miedo.
That's right. Even though it's a 2017 film, it didn't really make it to the States until 2019. So I guess we'll consider it a 2019 release when we do our best of list at the end of the year.
Yeah.
Whether or not it makes it will depend on everybody's taste, but we'll consider it. So, once again, Tigers Are Not Afraid. It's available now on Shudder, the movie channel that you can get for $5 a month. It's directed by Issa Lopez. Issa Lopez is a fairly well-known director in her own country. She's also a novelist, too, and she's won a number of awards and had some very high box office success for her other films in Mexico. And actually was lucky enough to even have Hans Zimmer score one of her earlier films. He did it for a buck, just as a fake transaction, because he wanted to do something exciting without any restraints, and he chose her film. So he and his group that he has around him did one of her films in the past. This film here, Tigers Are Not Afraid, was also written by Issa Lopez. It stars pretty much a bunch of folks I don't know, and I doubt any of us do, because none of the actors, most of the actors are young, and the handful that aren't are known in Mexico, but haven't done much in the States. The film is getting a 97% critical review on Rotten Tomatoes. It is been championed by people such as Guillermo del Toro and Stephen King. The movie, obviously for box office, it hasn't done much, only half a million. But again, this is an art house type film. And it was originally presented at Fantastic Fest in September 2017. So that's probably the reason why it's listed as a 2017 film. And it's a Spanish language film. So it's subtitled, though. I'm not sure how Shudder works. They may actually have a dubbed version, because I know, I don't know, though, but I know Netflix always has dubbed versions for all their TV shows.
I didn't see a dubbed version when I watched it last night. So
I just watched it today, but I didn't look for one either.
Yeah, I didn't either. I usually do, just for FYI, but I didn't this time.
I like Shudder, but it's usually kind of slim on the options.
Yeah.
On the audio, like, I do know they have a few titles where they have commentary tracks, but that has got a completely separate film entry. So you can watch, I think, like, Ruin Me had a commentary track. You can watch Ruin Me, and then a separate film is Ruin Me with commentary track. So it's not something you just flip between on the audio of the film itself.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I know Netflix can do it. I don't know that I've seen Shudder do it.
All right, very well. So once again, the film's called Tigers Are Not Afraid. We'll do the wiki after we give our thoughts and how we heard about this film, and so let's do a round table and discuss how we heard about it and what we thought. I guess I'll start. I actually heard about this film because Eric Webster, one of our co-hosts, said he had seen it and kind of said it could be a film of interest for the podcast, possibly, depending on the rest of us what we thought about it. And Eric was actually going to join us, but unfortunately something came up and couldn't make it. We needed a movie for tonight, and so I suggested it last week because I thought Eric would want to talk about it, and it's getting good reviews. But I went in blind. I didn't read anything about it, and I didn't see the trailer. And I have to say that this film is, it's really good. It's very fantastical, and it's more, a drama of a group of, orphans that live on the street of an unnamed Mexican city, where there's a drug war going on and human trafficking are going on. I can see why it's getting great reviews, the 97% on Rotten Tomato. I don't know if it's one of the best films out there, but I can see why it's still 97%, because even if people thought it's a decent film, it's going to get a fresh tomato on Rotten Tomato. So it could be that, but all in all, it's a solid film. It's a very depressing film as well. I was it wasn't an enjoyable watch, put it that way, because it's a depressing film. But it's a great film. So would I recommend it? Again, it depends on what you like. If you like art house, or if you like a Del Toro film, this film could be interesting. If you like drama, this is a good film. Straight horror, if you're that type of fan, you may not like it. But as a film itself, it's a pretty solid film, and deserves its accolades.
is one of those films where it's very debatable. It has horror elements, and it can be called a horror film, but it's horror aspect is debatable whether it actually happens or not, whether it's real or whether it's imagined by the lead fantasy. Character.
The real fantasy is more of a thing.
Yep. All right, so we'll talk about more of that and such, and how it compares to other films that may just be an unreliable narrator like Del Toro, many of Del Toro films and such. But Abe, what about you? Where did you hear about this film, and what did you think of it?
So I first heard about it when we were just trying to figure out what we were going to discuss. And so this was a film we settled on. I watched it today, not long after coming back from work. And I think it's a very, very solid film. I definitely agree with Phil. It's a very bleak film. It's really is depressing, especially seeing, you know, children in this dire situation. It's rather merciless film. And I definitely agree. It's also kind of difficult to categorize because I saw it as more surreal fantasy, where it's kind of, at some certain point, it's not to interpretation what exactly transpired, how much had transpired. And I think it's more of a drama, but it does have some horror elements, but not as much compared to other films where it kind of would really stand out as a horror film. I think if there was any other genre, it kind of had elements of a mystery. Because there is some kind of questions of not only what exactly is transpiring with our main character, but also just in regards to certain disappearances of her parent, her mother, and other people in this story's main conflict. It builds around a real life situation, a real problem within that culture, so I would, you know, but it was interesting to kind of see that, you know, after watching and seeing it alongside other films that are a little more fantastical and more horror centric, it was kind of interesting to see how it was how it end up there, because it is very art house, it is more surreal fantasy, it is more drama. But it is a very dark film. And it's going to be very interesting to kind of break it down and just kind of see what we can dissect from the whole thing.
All right, very good. Mike?
Yeah, so I just watched this last night. The film that most springs to mind is probably Pan's Labyrinth. Although it has the fantasy element is much more toned down here than in Pan's Labyrinth. But it is an aspect to it, in that it's a story told primarily from the point of view of a young girl, and you can't be entirely sure if what she's seeing is what's really happening. If you like that and are willing to and willing to see something that is even bleaker, then this might be a film for you. You had some children killed in it, so you know that's always a pick me up. But it's dealing with the drug war in Mexico and human trafficking in Mexico. And you're only really seeing things from the point of view of the kids. So you never get a great feel for exactly why certain things are going on that are going on. Just as kids probably wouldn't have a great feel for that. They would just know that it's happening and not have like the deep geopolitical context on which to understand it. It's got some really effective stuff. It's only about a 95-minute film, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's to its benefit. If this could have gotten very tedious if they tried stretching it out to 2 hours, or very pretentious.
Yeah.
83 minutes, actually. Yeah, and it,
oh,
absolutely.
That's it?
Yeah, yeah, and that's probably good that it was only 83.
Yeah, it's nicely paced, so it doesn't drag on. It just feels like just the right amount of story, and you know, just the runtime is just right. You know, I definitely agree that any longer could have really dragged this whole thing down.
So continue, Mike.
Yeah, because it is a very slight story. There's not like a lot of great interpersonal dynamics that you can have here. They're kids, so they're not getting a lot of introspection, and you know, and they do a good job of having the kids act like kids. The title is, you know, just referring to a fairy tale that kind of runs throughout the story. A lot of this has to do with trying, you know, a search for yourself and identity, kind of, and standing up for yourself. Where the characters are asked at the beginning of the film by their school teacher to make up their own fairy tale. And the lead character makes up the story of a prince who wants to be a tiger because tigers are not afraid, basically. But he can't be a tiger because he's forgotten to be how to be a prince, right? So in other words, if you don't remember who you are, you can't become your full self. You have to remember who you are, and that's kind of where the kids are, is they have to remember who they really are, is a part of that. I'd strongly recommend, and yet another reason to watch Shudder, to take advantage of Shudder, to use the code SCARES to get a free 30 days of Shudder. That'll give you plenty of time to get you past Halloween and see all the good stuff they have there. So, definitely a strong recommend. This is shot up to near the top of my list for the year. So.
All right. Very good. For folks, who don't know, I forget the actual word, but it begins with V. But the title is just one word with the letter V in Spanish. And I looked the word up, and that word translates to "They Come Back." So I guess the Spanish language name of the film would be "They Come Back,"
which is really weird because that you could do is an English title. Like what was it? They're Still Here, I think was the was that the cannibal film? No.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. We
are what we are. You know that. So they come back. Certainly can translate into English fine. Maybe there's context nuance that's being lost. I don't speak a lick of Spanish. And there's a whole lot there about Spain or Spain, Mexico, and the Spanish language that I'd be curious about in terms of certain characters and like, you know, do their names have extra meaning? With the symbolism of like the tiger and the snake and stuff like that I don't know if there's a cross-cultural difference in how they interpret it. And I just didn't have time to really investigate. This isn't like The Wailing, which I mentioned earlier, where cultural barriers were a real hindrance in understanding that film. This film is pretty much universal. You may be missing some nuance, but you'll get the gist of it.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, a lot of films, they change titles to be not direct translations and something else completely that I guess are related to the film. And Tigers Are Not Afraid, it works quite fine as the English title for the film. All right, so I have a wiki, so wiki.
Or energy.
Wiki. A dark fairy tale about a gang of five children trying to survive the horrific violence of the cartels and the ghosts created by everyday drug wars. So it's pretty much the wiki. So it doesn't really say much. But again, as you said, Mike, the movie is fairly sparse in it's I guess, you know, point A to Z. It's more of a day-to-day thing and what happens.
Like a survival story, pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so let's see. We can talk about anything and everything anything not that aren't spoilers right now. So yeah, I would say that the runtime of 83 minutes was perfect. As a great film, Mike, I would agree with you that I could see it, you know, going up a lot in you know, my end of year list. But oddly, this year, I've been grading films by enjoyment level rather than greatness, even though, for example, Midsommar is one of the best films of the year. I have that as one of my best films of the year, and it isn't necessarily an enjoyable film, but for me, it was enjoyable. So whatever I've enjoyed has moved up very quickly, including Midsommar, but this film, I was massively depressed most of the film. So I don't know how high I will bring it up on my list, because again, I just, for whatever reason this year, I've decided I'm judging films by enjoyment level rather than necessarily greatness level.
Yeah, this is not exactly a film that I think many people, after, you know, depending you know, how they can handle the content, what we will just sit through it again, because it is really, well, I mean, yeah, as Mike just pulled up, kids do die in this film, and quite graphically, in fact. And the setting is very oppressive. The danger is very based on real problems, you know, plaguing that country. It really hits close. It's a, as you said, Phil, it's very universal. So even without the supernatural elements, what is transpiring is very close to real, you know, real life horror.
Yeah, yeah. One thing that's interesting about this film is, like Mike, you said, we only watch it through the perspective of the kids. But whether it is fairy tale or if this is how it actually is, at least in this fictional city in Mexico, where children, when they lose their parents, they become street people rather than go to an orphanage. And it could be true, though Mexico is a very strong Catholic nation, and you would think they would have many orphanages and many orphanages that are probably directly run by the Catholic Church. At least in this film here, they show children that have become orphaned due to the drug wars or human trafficking that just land up on the street. And so it is interesting how that works. And I'm assuming, based off the lead character, it's a girl, when her mother disappears, and that happens pretty much in the first 4 minutes of the film, so it's not really a spoiler, we can assume that they rent, maybe, because she soon goes, leaves the house to live with these four other orphan children on the street, and such. But I guess we'll talk about some of that as we go.
Do we know when this film is set? And because they start off mentioning that the 2006 started the drug war. I don't, you know, I'm a New Yorker. I'm not on the border. I don't know exactly where the state of Mexico. I don't mean Mexico as a state. I don't know what the status of Mexico is currently in terms of its drug war and like when the worst of it was. You know, Mexico is a large country that is a diverse country, except for the fact it's filled with Mexicans. You know, it's different places are better. Just like the United States, there's different places. Obviously, Bel Air and Appalachia are two completely different locations. So this is going to be one of the worst sections of Mexico.
Right.
And, you know, during some of the worst parts of the drug war, and there's certainly Mexico is well known for having a fair degree of corruption. And that plays into this as one of the main characters is running for political office and is also the head of a drug gang or cartel or is involved in human trafficking.
Right. Also displayed, too, is the police presence and how the police respond to things. In other words, similar to Colombia or how southern Italy was back in the day, and maybe even still today, where political assassinations and police assassinations would occur. So if you were a police officer that decided to arrest drug lords or drug employees, drug cartel employees, or investigated or whatever, there was a chance that you would be hit.
Yes. Basically, any police resistance against the drug cartel was met with retaliation of varying kinds, like you say, assassinations or attacks on family. And we see a scene this displayed where several officers are approached, but they do not want any part of what is going on.
Right. Once they see who's involved, they say no and they drive away. And whether that's because they're being paid off, because, you know, as Mike mentioned, there could be corruption where cops take money on the lam or whatever. But this seemed more apt to be that they were scared and they said, yeah, we don't have anything to do with this, because if we do, we'll be assassinated. Let's see. I guess we should probably throw out the spoiler now, I guess, because we'll talk about some of these side stories, because they all directly lead to the main topic of the film, or I should say the main plot. So we'll throw up the spoiler. If you haven't seen the film, you can watch it now on Shudder, and it's available there for free as long as you subscribe to Shudder. At this point, we will now critique and review specifics, and so that would require some spoilers as well. All right, so let's talk about this film. Mike, you kind of mentioned it during the explanation of what the title means. Our lead character has left home, say goodbye to her mother, and she's at school now, and the teacher wants everybody to write a story. And since these are younger children, probably third or fourth graders, what interests them may be fairy tales. So, as you said, Mike, write your own fairy tale is the assignment. And during that assignment, there's a drug war attack outside the school, and all the children and the teacher have to hit the floor. And, of course, some of the children are crying and panicking, including our lead character, the girl named Estrella. And the teacher, to try to calm her, says, don't worry. He gives her three pieces of chalk and says, each piece of the chalk is a wish. Everything will be fine and whatnot and whatnot. So that's pretty much the start of the film right there. It seems like a normal school that you would see in any country or any place that me, Abe, or Mike would live. But they shock us immediately to show that even though the school seems nice, you know, the teacher's good and they're learning and whatnot, the area that the school's in is not good because when you have to hit the floor because gunshots could go off stray and come through the windows or whatever, then it's not a safe environment for anybody.
Basically, the drug war has caught civilians in the crossfire, and so even every day-to-day life is just hazardous.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so to go to the next part of the film. So basically the tiger and the prince and all that, so that's going to play a lot throughout the film. But she walks home, and during her walk home, a blood trail follows her, like supernatural trail. It's kind of interesting. And then she comes upon the gangster, or what we assume is a gangster, that's dead on the ground, and the cops are around the body and whatnot. And when she gets home, her mother's gone, and she pretty much knows, I guess it must be common in this city, that when your parent has disappeared from your home, they been, especially woman, most likely, human trafficking has happened, where the mother has been kidnapped and is probably going to be sold to, I guess, brothels or who knows what horrible things happens to people in human trafficking. And so this is where she becomes basically an orphan, because it appears the father's out of the picture. It doesn't appear that she has any other family in the area, because there's no mention of uncles, aunts, cousins, grandparents, or anything. So she's abandoned and whatnot. All right, so what do we guys want to talk about? So that's pretty much the setup of the film.
Yeah. Basically, you know, I guess what we can start with the very fact we can see just how the drug war has pretty much sucked the life out of, you know, these communities and stuff like that. Because we not only see people, the parents and people disappearing, but people completely leaving their homes. Because at one point, well, she's just kind of, our main character, her name, I think, is...
the main character's named Estrella.
Estrella, thank you. Estrella is standing outside her house. She sees some of her neighbors leaving with everything they have. Because most of the environment is just completely silent or dead, because everyone's just trying to get away from the drug war. Because any of them can be targets, because, as you said, people are being kidnapped for human trafficking for whatever means necessary, or people are just being completely outright murdered. And that's what adds to this really oppressive, horrifying feeling, because it's just a very a ghost town most of the time. In fact, aside from our main characters and our antagonists and the random police we run into, we don't really have any other people in sight. You know, it's just that kind of small cast and that kind of small human presence.
Right. Yep. Now, Mike, you said you I'm similar to you. I'm not really familiar with the situation in some of these areas that I guess the drug war is prominent. I mean, we've seen films like Sicario and things that kind of show, I guess, the crime side of it and the police side of it. But this is fairly new, at least to me, probably to you too, right, Mike? This type of, you know, children and all that.
Well, I mean, the specifics, I guess, are new. It's not like I don't know. I mean, I did see the last Rambo movie, which is about him going into Mexico after his not quite adopted daughter is kidnapped for human trafficking. But I mean, I know it goes on. I know Mexico. That's a big issue with when people talk about immigration at the southern border and illegal immigration, is there is issues with human trafficking is definitely a problem. So I'm aware that it goes on. I don't know exactly the details. I have not been able to log on to the dark web to get more specifics. But it's there is some disturbing stuff going on there. Obviously, we know about the various drug cartels and, you know, the amount of violence that goes on. And it's one of those things that we're just kind of glad that we don't have to deal with, but obviously for some people it's very much the life that they're stuck with, right? So yeah, I don't know enough about the details to speak to the accuracy of this film. Obviously, if I would be more I guess I would be more skeptical if it was being made by an American filmmaker about Mexico, right, instead of being made by Mexican filmmaker.
Sure.
But at the same time, I also know that American filmmakers can fuck up aspects of what's going on in America too. So yeah. I don't necessarily think this has to be 100% on the button.
Oh yeah, I agree. It's all about execution. It's about, I think, agreed about the research put into it. If you're going to try to talk about a culture's, you know, situation, but even if in its borders, yeah, you can fuck up. I think that's really nice though, is that there's even though there's a lot of darkness, there is some bit of light to it, just in terms of the humanity displayed by our main characters, just in the moments when they have levity. I think that really helps kind of, you know, it just kind of makes you feel not so much as a giant hammer of darkness being beaten under your head, but feels like more of it feels like a natural progression of events. I don't know how to explain it, but it doesn't. It feels like it is telling a story first rather than trying to hammer in dark, shocking moments. Because there are some interesting themes and some really great moments of exploration of characters.
Right. Yep. And speaking of that, one of the next scenes is one of the scenes with one of the other children, and this child's name is Shine, or at least, you know, his nickname, he just goes by that on the street. And we see him follow this drunk guy who takes a piss in an alley, and this is middle of the night after, you know, I guess Saturday night partying or whatever, and he goes over to the guy and steals the guy's cell phone and notices that the guy has a gun as well, and he steals the pistol, and he puts the pistol to the guy's head to kill him, or at least pretend to, and then he doesn't, and then he leaves with the pistol and the phone. The guy walks away unaware because he's drunk. It was a weird way to introduce Shine, because it made him look like he was, you know, like a punk or something that we've seen in other films. But we learn backstory about him and the man he just robbed, because the man that he just robbed isn't just a Saturday night partier. It's actually a local mob hitman.
He's got a gun tucked into the back of his pants. So
yeah,
right, yeah. I mean, again, I don't know the laws in Mexico, but if the city's dangerous, it wouldn't surprise me that a lot of people would be carrying protection anyway. But you're right. I mean, the way he's casually has the gun just hanging out of his pocket, it kind of makes you think that maybe he was a bad guy anyway. So I could see how you guys felt that right off the bat, while I wasn't even sure at that point. But you guys were right, and I was wrong. He was a bad guy.
Another interesting thing is it kind of explores the title as well in that very moment where we're talking about princes wanting to be tigers, or people, those feeling powerless who want to be strong and stuff. But, you know, in order to be tigers, they have to be able to fight and stuff like that. And there's hesitation, fear of doing so. Whether it's just the act of killing or the act of resisting, because it's a step forward that's very scary. And this is one thing that the character Shine struggles with throughout.
Sure. It's a weird message, too. And I'm just thinking of this now. This isn't anything I was thinking of when I was watching the film. But being a tiger can be interpreted two ways. One is that it could mean being strong and loyal and honorable, but it also could mean violent and mean and angry and a predator. It's curious if the whole thing was double meaning or not, but probably not. I'm thinking it may just mean the first, like, because it's kind of directly related to the little fairy tale Estrella was writing in class, where, like you said, Mike, a person can't be a tiger if they don't remember who they are in the first place. And I think the tiger is supposed to be honorable and not a predator. And then also, we do learn that Shine is the leader of the Street Kids. So it's him and three other boys. One is a young boy who's I guess kind of innocent, named Moreau. He's a little younger than everybody. And then the two others are kind of
Tusky and then Pop.
Pop.
Right. Yeah, and they're followers of Shine. And Shine is the leader probably because he's the most street-weary. What's that?
Not just street smart, but also the most aggressive of the two, because he's the one who keeps having this kind of bravado and kind of this sort of, at least this presentation of confidence, which the other kids kind of get pulled towards because they need somebody to turn to for leadership and survival.
Right. Yeah. One of them looks older than he is. I remember if it's Pop or Tuxie. But that could just be, you know, their appearance. They're at an age, they're like pre-adolescent, but late pre-adolescent. So probably like 10, 11, 12, I would think.
Mm.
And you get a lot of variability and maturity at that age. So one could just look a little bigger and older, but, you know, maybe he's, again, it's a lot is his personality. He probably isn't as quite hard-headed. Maybe isn't as mentally mature or assertive, but yeah, Shine is definitely their leader.
Yeah, he's definitely the most angry as well. And we do learn that the four of them are similar to Estrella in the sense that these kids aren't abandoned or necessarily come from bad families. What they happen to be are children who have lost their parents to the drug war and human trafficking. So whether or not their parents worked for the mob or the cartel and were killed off, or whether they were people that owned a store and they refused to pay racketeering charges and they were killed off, or maybe similar to Estrella's family, the mother of the children was pretty, and so they looked good as targets for human trafficking, for brothels and who knows what, sex trade and so forth. So all of them lost their parents that way. It wasn't they're not runaways, in other words. And I think that's a very important aspect, because a lot of times we see movies, at least in the United States, when we have orphans and runaways and stuff, they're all there because they're runaways. They're not there because their parents were killed in some sort of drug war or malicious way. If that had been the case, at least in the United States, or films that we've seen where this type of thing would occur, those children would be put in adoption homes and orphanages and things like that, and they wouldn't necessarily be street children. But here, I guess it must be common, or at least in this fictional, quote unquote, fantasy world that this film takes place. Because again, even though it is fairly realistic, it also is a parable in a sense as well, I think, like a Del Toro film.
Well, yeah, but I think it's, I know, I think it's based in reality. I do think there are places where,
yeah,
that's an issue. I mean, I'm sure there are places you go in the United States where it's a little easier for a kid to get away with being a stray than in other places. You know, especially if you're dealing with a place like California where it's warm weather and you have a real homeless problem out there, because, you know, you don't have cold snaps that kind of force people to come in to shelters and get registered and inspected in the same way. You know, in Mexico, it's a lot easier to live out in the streets than it would be in Saskatchewan.
Yeah, and also because there's less influence by the police and other authority figures who resist the drug cartel, it's easier for things to completely fall apart in neighborhoods and society and other communities because of it.
Yeah, that's true too. So I think though, at least for viewers of this film that would necessarily come from at least our country, it's definitely, at least for me, feels very new to me, because again, usually when we have stories about orphans in the United States, or movies from other countries about orphans, those orphans are usually picked up for orphanages and things of that nature. I don't think I've seen too many street children or street people films unless they were runaways specifically. So I've seen many where they've been runaways, but I've never seen anything like this where the parents were killed off and the kids just land up on the street. But I don't know. Maybe either you folks have seen anything like that before.
Well, if you take a look at the area that they're in, you know, it's not good. You know, you're not dealing with you're dealing with a slum area, right?
Yeah,
right.
You're not seeing like a whole bunch of shopping malls, where law and order doesn't seem to be the nature of the day. You know, it's the I really don't have a problem with that. I suspect there's a lot more truth to it than.
I don't mean a truth. I mean new. And this is new to me. So to see a film like this where children were on the street. It is an interesting city because it's a sprawling city and it doesn't have any skyscrapers. So it's just like hundreds of houses or tenements or whatever, all, you know, no bigger than the two stories. And it just sprawls forever because when they show the children on the roofs of their of houses, because that's where they usually live, is they live on roofs of like office buildings or whatever. You see in the distance just a sprawling city. It kind of makes it very smothering, I felt, because I'm so used to like forests and things like that, and you don't see anything like that here. Even if this is a desert area of the country, there you don't even see the desert. So it's very, very claustrophobic too, I felt. All right, so what else do you guys want to talk about?
I'll talk about another thing would be about the since we're in spoilers, I'm guessing.
Yep.
Another thing too about how the drug wars not only affected communities and stuff like that is also just the influence of how these criminals tried to get in political seats of power and stuff like that. Because we find out that our lead antagonist is actually taking on identity of a political figure and trying to gain more control. It's kind of another thing that adds another thing of a very impressive feeling is just the lack of, you know, we already have, how should I say, I think what adds things, adds another level of bleakness to the story is that our young people, you know, they're still kids. They're just kids. And they're, and, you know, even though one of them has a gun, they seem almost completely powerless to control what is happening in their world. And I think that's what makes it another thing that's very depressing, because they can't influence things, you know. Supernatural things aside, they can't influence things and see the world around them fall apart. And I think that's what really makes it a very difficult watch, because it's you're essentially seeing what it is like for people who are left behind by the tragedies of this drug war, these crimes and this stuff like that. And I think that's what I think that's a part of the horror more than the ghosts and other things. Is just that. It kind of reminds me a little of how reading The Road kind of left me feeling. That very sense of how the world has already been ravaged by a terrible tragedy, and how the characters caught in it can't really change it, but can only survive in it.
Yeah, and well, the thing is, this is where that argument of how do you define horror? Like, you can pick any movie that's a war movie or something about a genocide and it's horrific, but the fact that it's real events keeps us from tagging it as a horror film. So there is a real life horror in this, and it provides a backdrop for the more fantastical elements that kind of get introduced. Because I'm trying to look. So the girl, Estrella, she really gets her first wish, right? This is what introduces the fantasy element.
Yeah.
And that happens quick in the film.
Yeah, basically she gets these three pieces of chalk from her teacher, who I guess she's trying to comfort her during the gunfire during class. And then when she gets home and her mother's gone, she's left alone, she tries to wish for her mother to return. But we kind of learned of Salva's rule is that her wishes don't have a straightforward effect. They happen, but there's always a cost or some kind of horrible twist to them.
Right. Well, she finds that out the hard way.
Yeah.
She wishes, as you would in classic monkey paw fashion, she wishes, I wrote it down exactly, I wish my mom would come back. You know, if you've read any sort of a horror story or seen any sort of horror movie, you know that's a terrible, terrible wish.
Yeah.
And we get an image of her mother, her mother's ghost, and she's like wrapped in plastic. So it doesn't go well. And this is an image that's going to haunt her throughout the rest of the film. But we never really know, is it real? Is it something she imagines? She does eventually find out the fate of her mother, and it is tied into that whole wrapping of the plastic, which could give an implication that there's truth to it. But at the same time, if she's been living in this culture, in this community, she's surely heard stories, and it's probably not hard for her brain to connect that wrapped in plastic is how a lot of these dead bodies turn up.
Mm.
So a lot of leeway either way.
Right. Yeah. No. And that's a fair point. The ghost of her mother appears, or what we assume is the ghost, or a vision, or something, because when the wish happens, she begins to start seeing her mother, as you said, Mike, wrapped in plastic, sometimes a little bloody, always. Scary image, because it's a lot of times we see her in the dark or in abandoned rooms or abandoned buildings where she is confronted by her mother. And that's a good point, Mike, which is, is it real what she's seeing, or is this just a figment of her imagination, from various, being various stresses, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you can gather that from that point on, is supernatural things really happening, or is she our unreliable narrator and just a child alone in the world and scared?
Yeah, and we kind of see that throughout the entire film, she's the only one to ever see any of this. Like,
right.
So that also kind of leads to the question of how much of this is actually existing, or is it some kind of coping mechanism that is being twisted by the horrors of her reality. Because it's almost like someone who tries to use some kind of fantastical imagination to try to deal with her situation is irreversibly pulled back by the terrible reality. Which ties into every time her wish, she makes a wish, something goes bad. And there's always, for the most part, there's always some kind of explanation of why a wish fails or becomes twisted.
Right. Yep. And she's very knowledgeable on that, because later in the film, one of the boys, specifically Shine, asked her to make a wish, and she says that no, it doesn't turn out always like I hope. And as you said, Mike, monkey's paw type of thing.
And something terrible happens, and which is weird, because she's got she's got three wishes, and she's only makes two. Where did I write the second one? Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, and she only makes two wishes, and she realizes something bad happens. The second wish was interesting.
She does make three.
Right. She does at the end, I'm saying, she comes to the realization that bad things happen after only making the second wish.
Right.
And I don't even know if bad things happen because of the wish, because it's kind of the nature of the wish that she asked for in the first one. She doesn't ask for her mother to be alive. She just asks for her mom to come back. But she's a kid. And it's a fairy tale. So she's alone in the house without mom. She wakes up and runs out into the kitchen from a noise. And it turns out it's Shine who's looting the house. Right. And Shine's wearing a tiger mask, which is a recurring theme with this particular group of kids. And she sort of chases him down to where his gang is hanging out, and tries to join in, and they don't want to let her join in because they say quite wisely that girls are bad luck.
Right.
And that really kind of sets up that dynamic. And we know Shine, in stealing things, he's got a phone. He's like, they criticize him because he's picked up one phone and say, why did you get another phone? We haven't even gotten rid of the last phone we had. And that becomes a plot element, is the two cell phones, that he's got the gun, and there's other elements. So these kids are just living off the street and whatever they manage to steal or find, and scavenging, and eating whatever scraps of food. I think they're eating beans when we first, or whatever they're eating.
Beans, popcorn, anything that can pretty much scavenge, it seems.
Right, and they're the one kid,
ramen noodles with the peas in them. You remember?
Right, and Morrow is being chastised by Shine because he's picking out the peas. He doesn't want to eat the peas, and so that tells you a bit about Shine. While he may be the tough kid, quote unquote leader kid, he's also sort of weirdly the mother figure, the parent figure, in telling him to eat Morrow to be eating his vegetables.
Right. Yeah. He's almost like the father, trying to keep everybody in line and have some semblance of like you said, a parent figure.
So it turns out the character by the name is Kako? C-A-C-O, right?
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Who we think is one of the henchmen, the odd job to the gangster's Goldfinger. It's his gun that's been stolen. It's his phone that's been stolen. And we know that he had something to do with, do we know at that point? Yeah, they mentioned that the mom has been taken by the Huascas, H-U-A-S-C-A-S.
No idea. I looked it up. It's It's actually a region and city in Mexico, and I guess it's just named after they named the gang that comes from there.
The Huascas.
The Huascas, yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. So I looked it up.
Right. So Shine says that the Huascas and Caco had taken your mom. And they say, and they know that since he's got his gun and his phone, they're going to be looking for them. So he said, if you kill him, you can stay. And so they coax her to go try to kill, to break into Caco's house and shoot him. And that gets an interesting exchange over who's the man in the family, right? Where she's, and again, that idea of transformation. And she, because she says, hey, you kill him, you can stay. And she said, you're the man, why don't you kill him? And his friend said, yeah, you should man up. He said, no, you turn into a man. You want to be a man, go, you go do it. So they get to the house. They can, she sneaks in through the gate. She walks up behind him, and she, instead of killing him, wishes I didn't have to kill him.
And then the guy just slumps dead, and she then looks over and sees a bullet hole. And this is where I mentioned that, you know, her the so-called wishes and the things that happen because of this have logical explanations, which kind of can create a little bit of questioning of were the wishes real.
Right. And because it has a, and it becomes, but also, are we seeing what we're seeing? Did she
exactly.
shoot him or did she not shoot him? And that's kind of up for debate. How did he really die? Did he, was it somebody else who shot him? When did they shoot him? Right. Because don't we hear a gun go off?
We do, but
that was when she dropped the gun in panic.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, after she saw the bullet hole in the guy's head. She panicked, and then she dropped the gun and went off.
All right, so... she brings the gun, she returns... She finds
several other kids. Moro.
Who had been taken.
Taken,
right.
Yeah.
So I'm skipping over my notes because I wrote that down. I forgot to put. So, right. So she saves Moro and the children. Is this where the ghost? Because I have it here. This is seems like it was one of the ghosts. So the one who killed him is looking for you. Bring him to me.
Right. Right, and I didn't know what that meant, whether that meant simply, I'm the ferryman type of thing where her mother's ghost or whatever is the ferryman that's going to take the person to hell or to the afterlife, or does that mean bring him to me so I can kill him? And I wasn't quite sure. But...
Yeah, it's kind of hard to say, you know, because if you use the question of, you know, how much of the supernatural is real, or whether this is just the girl's mind playing tricks on her, maybe a bit of it one revenge or something like that. It's kind of an escalation of what she starts to see, because she sees like little things like a snake from the gun coming alive. She sees her mother a few times, then she sees a little black dragon, then suddenly she sees more ghosts of more victims, and just kind of leaves the question of, is this just a buildup of mental turmoil, or is it actually the supernatural escalating in its presence because of all her wishes, or just being touched by whatever power is granted to her?
Yeah, and you know, we learn, we see more things as we go. I mean, even as the film went and the ghost, he says, bring him to me, to, you know, when they talk about other people later in the film, it still wasn't 100% clear, but it is ominous either way, I would think.
It's very ominous. And so I thought was really cool is the effect had on how the film presents the ghost in these kind of the plastic wrapping and everything like that. it's really unnerving because it just it's packaged flat, decomposed in flesh, added with the Silent Hill kind of twitching and jerking movements. And I think that's really kind of how it adds this really foreboding kind of presence of this magic, which somehow also reminds you how certain ghosts are approaching other stories where they appear malicious and evil, even though they only want revenge or justice for what was done to them.
Right. Right. And I guess it makes sense, but whether or not they're real or in her imagination, and even though she's a good person, anybody that has had such a horrible crime happen to them and their family, you can still see them having like the wish belief. Yeah, you know, you imagine it happening in your head where you want vengeance and whatnot, but of course you'll never act on it. And the ghosts, assuming that they're a figment of her imagination in one case, would be her wishes, right, of what she really hopes for the bad people.
Yeah. But, you know, it's a very natural thing because if someone has done something that terrible, even if you try to let the justice system carry out its duties and other things like that, it's, you know, that kind of anger and stuff like that is just, it's a product of that kind of trauma. It's especially for a child. You know, it's a lot for them to take in. I mean, this is one of the most extreme situations that a child could find themselves in.
Yeah, absolutely. So basically she takes credit for the death of Kako. And she saves Mauro and a few other boys. And it's kind of frightening to see that there's these little boys all in the back room in cages, and who knows what their fate are going to be.
Mm.
Is the guy a pedophile? Is he just a seller of humans? Is he just putting them in cages so he can bring them to dump them in the river? I mean, we just don't know, but either way, it's not good.
If it's human trafficking, if they're women, they can be more obviously put out to market, right?
Right.
They can be forced to work in a brothel with young children. You know, you've seen Megan Is Missing. You know, it's a little harder. You can't just set up shop in the middle of town. I don't really care what area of Mexico you are. That's not going to be an easy thing to do with people under a certain age. I have no idea, like, if they hunt for talent too, like recruiting. I know that there's places in Africa where they will they'll grab young boys and forcibly recruit them into whatever the local army is. I don't know to what degree that goes on with any cartels down in Mexico. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's probably the fact that they're in cages, it's probably not something good.
No. But it's interesting too, because where this individual is taking these kids for more likely market, I think it's his brother who's the main antagonist, seems to be just doing it for the sheer pleasure of killing, because he has his entire room dedicated to dumping the bodies of victims, and one of the videos is him just torturing, killing someone who happens to be Estella's mother. And it just seems to be no rhyme or reason to it, but just the sheer fact that he seems to just enjoy it, which is his brother catches on his phone, which ends up being the MacGuffin for the rest of the conflict.
Right. So what happens is that they're boasting, well, not Boston. They free these kids. Two of these kids want to be returned to their brother, Brian, B-R-A-Y-A-N. And by returning the kids to their brother, this ends up getting back to Alcino, who is the guy running for office, the head of the cartel, that it's this girl who's taking credit for killing Kako, that he was there, that they have the phone that they stole from him, and he wants that phone. He wants to get that phone back, so he knows they have that. And now this is going to create a problem because now the drug cartel is hunting for them. They think they're hunting for them because they killed Kako, but eventually it comes out they want it because of the phone. And on the phone is footage that Kako had recorded of them killing Estrella's mother, of specifically Alcino killing her mother, which of course is evidence that can be used against him in even a Mexican court of law, or at the very least can hurt his election chances.
Also, the thing that was interesting about all that is the person that is murdered on the phone. We aren't sure who it is. It's just a woman that's being beaten up and then murdered. And then later we find out it's actually Estrella's mother, because Estrella still thinks her mother is still out there somewhere. Basically what happens is that Shine watches the video and notices a bracelet around the woman's arm. And the thing is that the woman, you can't see her face because she has a bag over her head. And then the thing is he had seen a picture at Estrella's house of Estrella and her mother, and the mother wearing the same bracelet.
Right.
And so that's
Estrella.
Yeah, go on.
Right. He's got a thing. He doesn't want to give up the phone. He doesn't want to sell the phone, unlike the other phone that they were trying to sell. And the reason it's because it has a picture of Shine's mother on it. And the mother has been beaten up, you know, so she's not in a good place. But this is clearly part of the human trafficking thing on the phone. So there's evidence on the phone. That's our first evidence on the phone. And he asks Estrella about, you know, photos of her mom. She said, well, I left them all at the house that she has abandoned. And she asks him about, you know, why doesn't he have any pictures of his mom? And it's because the gang basically burnt down his home. So all the pictures have been burned up. So he's going, now they have a good relationship. He goes to her home to steal one of the pictures and I guess and bring it to her. And it's a picture of Estrella and her mother, and the mother's got her arm around Estrella, and you can see this bracelet of birds on her wrist that we saw in a previous flashback.
Right.
Estrella asking, Mom, when can I get your birdie bracelet? And Mom basically saying, over my dead body, in a nicer way. Basically, you can have it when I'm, you know, when I'm dead and gone. And so birds end up being a recurring motif in the in the film. She keeps hallucinating or seeing visions of various things, including birds. There's a little dragon, later a little tiger, that are and like that blood trail that are leading her there to different places and taking her to different or just symbolizing different things.
Yeah, usually little dark birds like that, they kind of look like crows on the bracelet, usually are like, or ravens, usually, you know, representative of death and stuff like that, or messengers and stuff like that, which fits well considering that the dead are trying to deliver a message of a request to Estrella to have their deaths avenged.
Right, exactly. Also, they find out, meaning Shine and the other three boys, that Estrella did not actually kill Kako, and that he was already dead when she showed up at his house to kill him. And for her, she thought her wish came true and that he just died magically because of the wish. But in reality, what it was is the guy that's running for office, who's also the mob boss, killed Kako because Kako recorded him murdering what happens to be Estrella's mother and losing the phone. So the evidence is now in someone else's hand, meaning Shine's hand. And so Shine says to Estrella, this is where we begin to begin. Let me rephrase that. This is where us as the audience begin to possibly understand that this may be a fantasy in her head, meaning she's an unreliable narrator, because he, Shine, puts it in perspective, which is there is no wishes. You're imagining it.
Yeah. And it also ends up being revealed at the worst time, the worst moment, because one of the kids, Moro, is killed after a run-in with one of the henchmen.
Yeah, Kako's brother, who is now not only wants vengeance for the death of Kako, but also is in hot water because now it falls to him to get the phone.
Right.
Right. And that's actually one of the beginning of the depressing reality is when, that they risk a lot to get Morrow back. And she wishes for the death of Kako to get Morrow back. And yet, after they get Morrow back and he's the innocent kid who's seen something and hasn't spoken since, he's got the pet tiger, he's the baby of the group, and everybody's watching out for him. And, we've already had this close call with him earlier in the film, and yet he ends up getting tragically gunned down by accident, catching a stray bullet.
Well, not necessarily by accident. What happens is...
Was it true? Otherwise, when you're shooting at them... No, you're right. He does shoot him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, yeah. What happens is he finds out where they are, right? And he wants to get the phone, Kako's brother. And he takes one of them as a hostage. And so Morrow, who now has Kako's gun, shoots Kako's brother.
That's right. Yeah.
And then Kako's brother, obviously, shoots wounded. And shoots Morrow. Actually kills him, yeah, in cold blood. Well, yeah, I mean, technically it's self-defense, but I mean, it's also... he's a bad guy.
Like a 7-year-old with a gun, so I don't know how. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So it's shocking and massively depressed. And at that point was when I was beginning to find out, or at least determine, that this movie is going to go very dark and is not going to be Julia Roberts in the Hooker movie. What the hell was that called?
Pretty Woman.
Pretty Woman, yeah. So there ain't going to be like that where someone's in dire straits that is saved. Once we see Morrow get killed, especially after they saved him from a horrible existence, when he was captured by Kako, and then he gets killed by a bullet, I was like, okay, this is going to be a massively depressing movie the rest of the way.
Oh, yeah. And it just gets worse from that point on, because the boys, after finding out the truth that Estrella did not kill Kako, abandon her because they're grief stricken by what happened to their friend, and then more ghosts start to plague Estrella, and they basically are trying to, they're just split apart at this point. This is pretty much the dark. Middle act.
Right. I actually thought it was funny how they all got pissed at Estrella because they found out that she, at least in their eyes, that she lied about killing Kako, when in her eyes she thought she actually did because she wished him dead. But the thing is the only reason the mob is after them in the first place is because Shine stole the phone. So if Shine hadn't stolen the phone, none of this would have happened in the first place. However, the reason he stole the phone was for the fact that it was Kako and his, I guess, mob or cartel or whatever they call them, were the ones that killed his parents as well. Because all the orphans in this, the five of them, were all their parents were killed by Kako's cartel. So
I kind of talk it up to this, just everybody being absolutely grief stricken. Sometimes when people are that upset, especially kids, sometimes they misplace blame or they need somebody to blame.
Yeah, that's a good way. Yeah, because we got to keep on remember, even though they're smart and streetwise and whatnot, they're still just children.
Yeah, and they just lost one of their closest friends as well to a horrible death.
Right, right. And it's kind of weird, too, because you're right. Because, I mean, not only is it technically it's Shine's fault because, in some ways because he was the one that stole the phone, but also Estrella actually saved Morrow from the cage. So he wouldn't even been there in the first place if she hadn't done that. So you're right. It's just misplaced anger because of their situation and such.
Right. Well, the problem is Estrella's the one that lets them in on the fact that they have the phone.
Right.
That's and it's so it none of this would have gotten back to them.
That's
all
true.
Of this. If it is basically still kind of her fault.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Mark. Yeah,
that they find out that this kid has the phone. Now, of course, the kid could have sold the phone and then they wouldn't have had it. And there's all sorts of things. But these are children with child logic. You know, I think what was a great little scene is when they're in their little bunker, whatever, and they're watching TV and they turn on and a music video comes on and the kids just all start jumping up and down, dancing to the music video, you know, and for all the shitty lives that these kids are dealing with, that's such a like little kid moment because they all dance horribly. they're kind of bouncing up and down and calling it dancing. There's still a measure of innocence there. There's still immaturity there. There's still childhood there. When they move, when they're forced to move on, so they're then found, and they find this, you know, elaborate home, you know, with a fish tank, and they find the fish are now the fish tank are in a puddle in the floor, and they call it's like a zoo for fish. It's a weird.
Oh, and they also say that the fish are like the tiger in the sense they escaped and now they're free.
Right. This is the legend of the tiger that goes back from the beginning. Was that it's sort of like almost like a Scarface thing. There's a wealthy man who once had a zoo and in his home, and I guess the bad people came to and killed most of the animals, but the tiger had gotten away. And now the tiger lives on cats and dogs and homeless children, or orphaned children, rather. Yeah, so it's a weird little world that these kids have. But so what was I going to say? I don't remember what I was going to say now. So they also find soccer balls, right? This is their big thing. They get there, you know, they're being pursued, but all they care about is having a place to play soccer.
Mm.
You know, and they decorate their soccer balls, which, you know, with Sharpie markers, you know, this is what they're concerned with because they're kids.
Right. Yeah. Oh yeah. Well, just first of all, finding this building that's abandoned without any, squatters is huge. And then it's cool to have the fish and then it's like koi and stuff. So they're real, you know, expensive fish. It's not just like, you know, kibbies in a pond. And then, to find all the soccer balls, and you know, you're a kid, you have nothing anyway, and kids that have nothing that are also orphans that live on the street, and then suddenly you find a box of soccer balls that are all new. I mean, this is huge, you know. So this is exciting. This is the good times, and so there is some levity at points in the film like this, even though you know the next scene, you know, everything is bleak again because there's still homeless, without parents, with no future, and the mob is, or cartel is after them still, you know?
Yeah. And yes, I think that's what it really does well, is just this balancing of the, of humanity and horror. I think it's just kind of how real life is. I mean, there are terrible moments, but there are moments of hope and there are moments of light. And I think that's what this film really does a good job of balancing it. Before, you know, it kind of really eases you into the darker stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, so Morrow's is dead. And so all that stuff that we talked about when they found the soccer balls and whatever, that was all before Morrow's death, obviously. Because once Morrow's dead, there is no more levity in this film at all. Well, I guess we can get on to discussing the third part of the film now. Because this is where it ramps up and the main, focus of the cartel and what's going to happen and whatnot. So the phone keeps on ringing, and Estrella suggests that they should just pick it up. Because the caller ID says that it's the mob boss, and they know that they have the phone. And so this is what they pick up the phone, and they, actually all this happens, we kind of already went over some of this, right? Because when they pick up the phone, the guy, that's when the mob boss said, I actually killed Kako, and that's how I know you guys had the phone, because the girl Estrella was going around saying it was her, and so on and so on. So and then we have the scene where they disown her and whatnot. But she actually, there's an important scene for this third act where she keeps on seeing the ghost of Morrow now.
Right.
What do you guys think of that?
And the ghost of Morrow, and that's where the animated tiger comes in. And I will say, this is like the one place where this being a Mexican film, is obvious is that some of the animation is not that great.
Yeah, it's a little weaker. Yeah.
It's kind of weak CGI, but it's okay because it's a fantasy element and it works. You can roll with it.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's good for what it is, because I mean, obviously it's not Hollywood or New Zealand or Australia or Japan or whatever, where animation and CGI is like incredibly impressive, but it works. But either way, I liked how the ghost was, because the ghost was not necessarily wise. The ghost was still Morrow and the little boy and stuff. And I thought that was kind of cute. So I think if this was a figmentation of her imagination and not actually Morrow's ghost, and all these ghosts that have been appearing to her, when she would see Morrow's ghost, you would think his ghost would be a little different than the ones that were telling her to, you know, we want vengeance. Since she knew him so well, he was still the little boy that was, you know, I mean, he was so innocent, and the ghost is just a reflection of that. And if it's her figment of her imagination, then the ghost would be just that, which is what she thinks of Morrow, and Morrow is the little boy. Let's talk about some of that now before we get into the final act and explain what happens. What do you guys think? Was it supernatural, or do you think it was a figment of imagination? Because there, I mean, obviously, you could go either way, because some of the things, like, for example, the plastic around the mother's face, sure enough, that's how she died, and the ghost appears to her with the plastic around her face, you know, the plastic bag around her face, before they even see the video on the phone that shows her mother with the plastic around her face. So some of it's foreshadowing.
Well, that's what I think how strike the balance is that the horrors of the cartel's crimes are not, like, hidden behind yellow police tape because it happens so close to home. So it's very possible that Estrella has seen the similar killings to what she imagines happened to her mother being all over the place, maybe even on the news. So on one hand, she could have pictured that her mother's fate as the same as those victims. On the other hand, maybe it is supernatural, and she is seeing what has become her mother. And that's how it kind of goes with the case of her not wishing to kill Kako, and her very very last wish could have been just a terrible twist of fate, or was the wishes backfiring on her? I think that's another thing is where I could lean either way, because there's just enough there that you could see where either side could work as imagination or true supernatural influence.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I guess I'm thinking that it was all a figment of her imagination based off of things like you said, Abe, which is she could just assume that her mother had a plastic bag over her head because she's probably seen things like this before. But Mike, you were going to say something. What was your opinion?
Yeah, you can come up with plausible explanations, and it's going to be one of those things. It's going to be how you prefer to see it. Because all this is everything's a lot easier to see as very, very plausible explanations here. I kind of look at this whole thing as sort of like All Monsters Attack? What is that Godzilla film? Abe, what's the Japanese title? It was Godzilla's Revenge in the United States.
Oh,
where the kid is just hallucinating the kaiju.
All Monsters Attack.
Godzilla All Monsters Attack.
Yeah.
Yeah, where the kid is hallucinating the encounters with the various kaiju in order to deal with his bully. And the girl is kind of seeing these as an escape mechanism, as a coping mechanism. When you get to the actual ending of the film, you could kind of make an argument that a thing plays out a certain way that can only happen in a supernatural way, but that's only if you believe exactly what you see on screen is what actually happened. And again, so you have the question of her being an unreliable narrator. So yeah, I tend to fall in the category of that it's her imagination more than anything. But hey, yeah. If you want to believe that she's making wishes, no reason why she can't be.
All right, so let's talk about this final act. So I mean, the way that they dispose of Morrow's body in burial is just horrible because these are. I mean, it's not like bodies are just found on the street and then, you know, put in pauper's graves. I mean, there's just bodies thrown in rivers, whatever. And they do that with his body, too. The children, you know, that's how they bury him, instead of just leaving the body for someone to find to bury.
Right, but in their mind, they're treating it with respect.
Yeah.
Oh no, I'm not saying that's wrong. It's just interesting that... I mean, I'm just so far removed from a world like this that, like, for example, if a body died, a homeless child died in the city of New York or Boston or Chicago or San Francisco or any city in the United States, I would assume it would eventually be found. But you're right. I mean, even in those cities, they could throw the body in the river too. So, but either way, it was just shocking. I felt even if because I just assumed they would have abandoned the body or brought it to the street and ran or something. But either way, they bury his body and then they agree to meet with the mob to return the mob's phone. And there's four of them left now, so it's Shine, the other two boys, and Estrella, and they go and meet the mob. So, Mike, let's talk about that. How about explain what's going on? What happens here?
Well, they go to meet the mobster, and he looks, and they Shine switches the phone, right? Because he has the second phone, he switches the phone cases. And I'm going to have to assume that the mob boss is either deeply stupid or maybe coked out or something.
Well, what happens is Kako's brother says, yeah, that's my brother's phone.
Right. He says that's his brother's phone, and he goes to check it to see that the video is on there, you know, and check the history or whatever. Like, what did these kids do? Because the kids could have uploaded the video somewhere or sent it to someone.
Right.
And the kids say, well, we didn't have the code to open the phone. And that's the first clue the audience has, because they never cracked the other phone. They said we didn't get it. So, okay, so, you know, we couldn't get into the phone. And so El Chino is okay. He throws the phone down, and he steps on the phone, and he breaks it, and he shoots his two henchmen.
Yep.
Right.
I'm not entirely sure.
My guess is what you're probably going to say, Abe, which is they along with Kako were the three that fucked up, because they, you know what I'm saying? So that's why I think he did it. But what were you going to say?
Well, I think it's partially because they are not only failures, but also because they are potential leaks, because they now know he wants to get his phone back, and now they have knowledge of it. Plus, there was an agreement earlier that if they got the between Estrella and the leader, that if he got the phone back, the gang would quote unquote end.
And now, let me ask this: why do you think Shine switches the phones and just doesn't give him the phone he wants?
He probably wants to try to attempt to do the right thing, and also, you know, probably get back for his own mother's death.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. And remember, Kako recorded it to the theory to blackmail him. Right.
Right.
To have evidence over El Chino. So, right. And so maybe those guys were involved in that plot, but for whatever reason, again, we're dealing from the kid's point of view, and we don't necessarily know exactly what happened otherwise.
But at this point, two of the boys, the two other boys, they run. So it's really just Shine and Estrella, and we're thinking, okay, they're in trouble. But the mob boss or the cartel guy, El Chino, he goes by his word. He says, "I made a deal. If you brought me the phone, you guys can go. Get out of here."
Yeah. True. But, you know, it's clear that there's no loyalty among these criminals or any kind of trust either.
Right. So the other two kids get away, right? As soon as they get a chance,
they both
flee, because they're not dumb. they're off. They have no bravado. But the other two kind of stay there, and he says, okay, we made a deal, you can go. He lets them go, and you know, they're halfway out of the area, and at that point he realizes, oh, wait a minute, how could they have answered the phone if they didn't have the code to answer to unlock the phone,
right?
Because he's been having these phone conversations with them for the whole film, you know. And that was my first thought. And so either, like I said, either he's very stupid, or he was high on something, or because that should have been a very obvious
Yeah.
But one of the things we failed to mention is that, and I didn't think this was very obvious, because these kids are, you know, they're homeless and they're dirty, is that Shine has some burns on his face, apparently, from when his house was burned down.
Yeah.
Right. Yep.
And so she uses that final wish to wish his burns to go away, right? For the scars on his face to go away. And they go away.
Oh, yeah.
And she, like, makes a little X, a little cross. X marks the spot on his cheek where the burns are. And to us, it appears that the scars go away. And then there's a giant hole in his cheek where El Chino shoots him.
Yeah. Yeah, they...
Because El Chino's now figured it out. And so to kill Shine. And that... that is maybe my most unexpected death of the year.
Yeah, that shocked me. That really did.
Yeah, it was one thing to kill off Morrow, which was also shocking. You know, and to kill off a second kid on top of it, and this is like the, you know, the lead or the male lead in the film.
Right.
I was like, holy fuck. Boy, this film got really bleak fast. You know, it's just ending on sort of a happy ending, right? Everything is all good in the world, and they're going to know. But of course, you still have the issue with the ghosts, and the ghosts are not resolved, where the ghosts are saying you must bring
them to where we died.
Right. Bring us to where we died. And so it turns into a game of cat and mouse. And we realize that this is the place where we see where there was recorded the murder of Estrella's mother.
Yep.
And in the gate chasing cat and mouse, Estrella ends up in the room where they've dumped all the bodies that are wrapped in plastic. And is led there by Morrow's little toy tiger ghost, right?
Yeah. Yep.
And El Chino followers are in there. As she leaves, she comes into the ghost of Shine. And somewhere along the way, she picks up, gets a hold of Shine's lighter, right? The lighter that was used to burn his home down.
Yeah.
Right.
And she hands him the lighter, and he goes into the room with the bodies and sets it on fire and presumably kills El Chino.
Right.
Now, this is where, is that what really happened? Because if that were what really happened, then there's no logical explanation for it, you know, because something had to set the fire. Or is that how it plays out in her imagination? Was she, in fact, the one who set the fire? So it depends on how much you believe what you really see there.
Well, there's actually a fire caution sign on the door.
Right.
And so at one point you can actually hear Chino scream before the fire, suggesting that the ghost killed him. But there's also the possibility that she set fire to that room and killed Chino herself.
Right.
Right. Well, let's talk about the next two scenes, because there's also a third possibility. And so what happens is, after Chino's burned to death and killed by the ghosts, she walks out into the exit room of this building, and she sees a tiger there. And we can presume it's that tiger that was the teal that Shine was telling all the kids, which is there's a tiger that's loose in the city that used to be owned by a wealthy person who was killed, and they killed all the animals except the tiger, who escaped.
If it's even a real tiger.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Well, I'm just saying it how it's played out. I'm not necessarily this is exactly what happened. And then she opens the door to leave the building. The tiger ignores her. And we see this field, similar to like in Iowa, rather than in the desert area where she lives, because the city you can gather is in the desert part of Mexico, not the farming areas. And she travels off into this field that wasn't there before. So. And that's pretty much how the film ends. So the third opinion, and this is what I mentioned to Eric after I saw the film, I texted him, and I said that this is probably like Eliza Fields, and she's dead. And I'm thinking she got killed at the same point when Shine got killed, because the bullet went through his cheek and probably hit her too and killed her too. And this is her soul leaving and heading through the fields to heaven. And none of the part where the tiger appeared or where El Chino died actually happened.
I think if there's a part to that, I don't think the bullet makes as much sense to me.
Well, then she fell into that room where all the corpses were, and she was killed in that room.
Well, I think the best way, if that's the fact that she died and moved on, is that she's the one who walks back in the room with the lighter and sets the fire to the room, and she dies in the room.
That's possible too.
Yeah,
that I think would probably be the best place. But I think this is very much a multiple choice ending, and you can figure it out for yourself. You know, because this is a fairy tale ending in a fairy tale film. You know, is this how symbolic is this? Right, there's the tiger. Right. Is the tiger there really? Is a symbolic thing? Is she imagining it? She's free. You know,
but I think the field makes it.
Well, the field the field could be seen as the Elysian Fields or some similar thing. It could be seen as symbolic of the fact that she's free now, right? She's killed her mother's killer. In fact, they've kind of put an end to the gang in the area, right? Chino's killed his henchmen off. She's killed off Chino. Kako was the big was the more ground level threat that they were dealing with on probably a more regular basis. I'm sure there's still crooks there, but it's certainly going to put a crimp into that, and you might get a little. It might end some of the drug war in that area for a while. She's going off for freedom.
Why would the film show the tiger and this field that doesn't exist? Unless she was dead.
Well, especially because the field they've been chosen. Because we've seen birds and butterflies and blood trails and stuffed tigers and all these things that didn't exist throughout the film.
Okay. All right. So, based off of all the things that it could be, when I was talking to Eric, I said, I think she's dead. And Eric said, yeah, I think so as well. What about you guys? What do you think? I mean, again, it could be any of these because, like you said, it's open-ended where it could be a number of things. What do you guys think? Do you think she's dead or do you think she's alive?
I honestly think that she might have imagined the supernatural and perhaps had succeeded in killing Chino, but everything else could be just another thing for it to be art house kind of presentation of symbolic of earning her of being free and also completing the ending of her story from what she was writing in the beginning about the tiger.
She also could have gone insane too, right? I mean, that's a fourth option. But what do you actually think, Abe? Do you think she is free?
I just think that she had imagined these things. But the rest of the imagery used was to symbolize her earning her freedom and completing her story.
Okay, so you think she's alive, then, is what I'm asking.
Yes.
Okay. What about you, Mike?
I'm going to take the cheap out and say I really don't know. I finished watching this really late last night or early this morning, and I haven't had a chance to think about it in a whole lot of depth. I think this is a case where the text of the film, as I understand it, assuming there's not a lot lost in translation or whether it's literal translation or cultural translation, I think it could support either reading. I think it could support believing that she ends up kind of being free, or it could end up being that she's dead and she's gone off into the afterlife. I do wonder if I was sending her off to the afterlife, if I was the filmmaker, I think I would want to make it more clear if I wanted to make it more clear, you could have put her mother there. You could have put Shine there or Mara there, and it would have made it more clear that she was joining them. So the fact that he didn't do something like that,
she
didn't do something like that means that I think that she wanted it to be more ambiguous as to what happened.
Go
hit the Reddit boards to see what other people have done who have, you know, had a lot more time to think about this, or maybe found interviews that I haven't read, or maybe just speak Spanish or read Spanish, and so they could have checked some of the media out pertaining to that.
Sure. Yeah, I see your point. I mean, obviously, you know, the reason I think it it didn't matter that her mother was and Shine and all them weren't there when she was going to the through the field was because you got to go through the field first before you get to the gates of heaven or wherever. You also could say that her mother and Shine and all them were getting revenge on Chino as well. But again, yeah, I mean, it's ambiguous.
Yeah, it's also a choice. And
I mean, it's like you said, Abe, it's an art house presentation of an ending, meaning whether it was freedom and his symbolic way to show freedom, even though there's still no hope because she's still on the street with nowhere and now has no friends now except for maybe the two boys. But it also could be the symbolism of her going to heaven because now she's in peace. She doesn't have to deal with the weight of the world that leaves nothing for her anyway. And she's heading off to better places, i.e. The afterlife.
And the reality is, if she lives, there's still a really good chance a girl her age could still end up being abducted.
Yeah.
She's far from in the clear. Right. But that's getting to a really depressing story that we don't want to dwell too much on.
Sure.
However honest as that might be.
Sure. Yeah, that's a fair point. So what I would say is I wouldn't mind anybody who's seen the film that has listened to this podcast, what's your opinion of the ending? And email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com. Also, maybe I'll post that on the Facebook group too. Say, I saw this movie, Tigers Are Not, whatever the name of the movie is. I
afraid.
Yeah, Are Not Afraid. Yeah, for those folks who have seen it, what is your interpretation of the ending? And, you know, spoilers below or something like that. Because, yeah, you're right. I mean, one thing to do, Mike, is go check the Reddit boards and things like that to see what other people's interpretations are. I didn't go do that either, Mike, so I'm not quite sure.
I mean, it's not that the Reddit boards have necessarily the right answer necessarily, but, you know, there you're looking for people. Yeah. You're just getting more perspectives, and there are some people there that really do know their shit, or you know, have researched it, or they, I like this movie, but it's I like it a lot. Like I said, it's near the top of my list, but with the podcast and with, you know, life going on and so forth, this is the latest potato chip in my bag of potato chips for the year, and I'm going to be moving on to my next potato chip tomorrow, right?
Right.
Where other people, they're like, oh my god, this is the greatest movie ever, and they'll do a much deeper dive than I have the time to do.
Sure, sure.
You know, they'll dedicate their entire life. They'll be doing, you know, they'll be doing Shine cosplay conventions and, you know, whatever. They're just going to eat this up. So, all right,
sure.
Let them do the legwork.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's true. I mean, I'd be curious to read some of those things, but again, there's other movies of interest that have a lot of things that people could interpret as well. You know, for example, Ad Astra, the Joker film, a bunch of other films out there that have all these things that people can interpret as much as this film here, and it's like how many movies do you want to do that for, and how much time do you have, and have you already just made your decision anyway? So does it even matter what other people are saying? So yeah, that's a good point, Mike. But yeah, you're right, someone will be doing this as a paper at school to say, I think this movie's ending and what it was trying to say was this. So there will be stuff out there if people really do want to go out and look, just as I've already noticed those same things being done for movies like Ad Astra and Joker and on and on and on. So, all right. Any other things that anybody wanted to bring up in your notes or in your mind that you guys were thinking of that you wanted to bring up? I don't.
I said I'm good.
Okay, what about you, Mike?
Yeah, I'm good. Like I said, I've said my piece.
All right, sounds good. Yeah, so that's about 2 hours discussion, or an hour and a half, because we discussed some stuff before. So I guess we can give our final thoughts. So, Abe, why don't you start?
I thought this was an overall solid film. It's well shot. The kid actors are all fantastic. It's a very bleak film, but it really does ease you into the darker parts. The surrealism and the ambiguous nature of what is taking place is really interesting and does leave a lot of interpretation for each viewer, depending on how they see it. And if you have a Shudder membership subscription, I would recommend go check it out. It's a pretty good film. It's not exactly a fun film because of it's how depressing it can be. But it is a well-made film, and I think it still deserves a watch.
All right, very good. Yeah, for me, it's an excellent film, well done. It's more of a character study for a lot of the film than has a plot that does come to a conclusion. So as a result, its pacing of 83 minutes was perfect. It's definitely not a fun film or an enjoyable film at all. I remember Mike earlier had said that about We Need to Talk About Kevin, which was an episode that was just released by Dark Discussions, where Mike, you said that you thought it was an excellent film. However, it wasn't a film you would ever want to revisit necessarily. And it was not a fun film. And that's how I feel about this film here, because it is not a fun film at all. It actually left me very depressed afterwards. And as a result, I wouldn't recommend the film by any means to anybody who doesn't want to be depressed, or who is depressed. Why add this to your life? Because it really is a depressing film. But as a film, it's an excellent film, and it's well done. And it is worthy of the reviews that it's getting. But again, it's not a true horror film. And again, it's also very depressing. So it's definitely for a select audience and not anything that the mainstream would necessarily cling onto. So I can't necessarily recommend it, but it is great cinema. Mike.
Yeah, it's a hard film to define genre wise because it's got horror elements without being a blown out horror film. It's a drama with fantastical elements to it. So yeah, it's just Mexican horror film, Mexican film, I guess, foreign film. But you should get an idea from us talking about it, whether it might be up your alley or not. It is a well made film. It's a film that should stick with you. It's a film that has some real art and symbolism and so forth with it. I didn't find it be overly heavy handed as some of these films can be, and it didn't let itself get lost in its visuals, because it's a Mexican film, doesn't have the budget to do that. You could remove the fantasy elements from it and still have a very compelling child drama, admittedly one that might only be, 75 minutes long instead of 85 minutes long. So, I highly, highly recommend, again, try Shudder, use the code SCARES. I think that's still working for 30 days of free subscription if you haven't done it already. And really, for what is it, about $5 a month? That's about the cost of a video rental. So if you rent anything online, it's really not a bad thing. And you're helping to support a channel dedicated to horror films that's bringing us original horror programming. So what's the harm if you can swing it?
Yep, that's true. Also, yeah, you're right. They could get rid of the fantasy elements, and you'd actually not only a solid drama, but also a solid thriller too, I guess. Also, one other thing I wanted to bring up was that the five actors and actresses in the film, the five children, were just absolutely fantastic.
Yeah.
Especially Shine.
Very good.
Shine was unbelievable because his character, I think, had the most arc to how he had to act from scared and weak to strong and fatherly. But all in all five children were fantastically cast. Absolutely. All right. So that was Tigers Are Not Afraid, 2019 release internationally. Originally played at Fantastic Fest in 2017 during the festival circuits. As Mike said, it's a Mexican film, Spanish language, subtitled, directed by Isa Lopez, a name that is already well known in Mexico. And depending on what she does in the future, could be someone to look forward to in multi-language films, because she did go to Hollywood to meet with Hans Zimmer when he cast, or I should say, scored one of her prior films. So I assume she can speak English as a result and could do Hollywood-type films as well. So someone to at least possibly look for in the future. With all that stated, I think we can wrap it up. So, Mike, why don't you lead us out?
Thank you for joining the Dark Discussions podcast once again in this spooky month of October for our discussion of Tigers Are Not Afraid. Please tune in next week, where, if this is being released in chronological order, we will be discussing The Joker.
It should be a barrel of laughs for everybody.
Womp womp.